Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Unseen Beings podcast, where we explore what it means to be human in a more than human world. My name is Eric Champa Anderson, and I'm your host and the author of Unseen Beings: How We Forgot the World Is More Than Human. In today's episode, we're joined by Mike Fiorito, a freelance journalist and the author of The Hated Ones, Falling from Trees, Sleeping with Fishes, Call Me Guido, Freud's Haberdashery Habits, and Hallucinating Huxley. Some great titles there. His book, Mescalito Riding His White Horse, received the 2024 Independent Press Distinguished Book Award in the spiritual category, and Falling from Trees received the 2022 Independent Press Distinguished Book Award in the short story category. His UFO-themed science fiction novel, For All We Know, is now available for pre-order and will be released in May 2024. Thank you so much for being here, Mike. It's really great to meet you and great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Eric. I discovered you watching your podcast with Jack Hunter. Thought it was really inspiring. I've read Jack's books, and you'll notice Jack wrote a blurb for All We Know. So we
Yeah,
have our UK
I'll mention
connections.
that in a minute, actually. Yeah, I mean, Jack's work was really, I think, quite in some sense formative for me. It really influenced the way that I think about things a lot. And the same on the other hand, I felt like discovering his work, I had sort of found a kindred spirit who was saying a lot of the same things that I wanted to say, but venturing into territories that I didn't really know how to move into. And UFO studies was really one of those. The way that he really opened up many different approaches to things that we deem sort of paranormal or extraordinary or so-called supernatural, in a more conventional sense. He really, opened up my eyes quite intensely to that. So I was really excited to see that he had read your book as well, which I finished recently. I really enjoyed it. I hope that everyone goes out and gets it. It's really worth reading. But yeah, it's a great little connection we have there.
Thank you. I think too, Jack contributed to the book Deep Weird, which is a kind of interdisciplinary, and I love where this is going, where the conversation includes, ecology, it includes ufology, it includes psychedelic studies, it includes consciousness studies, and it's sort of this, there's a hub of connected ideas that we're conversing with each other. So it's, I find that very exciting and interesting.
Yeah, me too. And I really feel like it's, there have been sort of conversations in this arena for a long time, I suppose, but it feels like just over the past 5, 10 years, really 5 years, there's been a really significant sort of influx of new energy and sort of attention towards these topics and these really sort of unusual intersections, especially bringing ecology into the conversation, because I think for a long time we've sort of approached environmental topics and ecological topics in a very instrumentalist and sort of materialist fashion, and very reactive fashion. And I feel like it's somewhat recent that an entirely new sort of breath of deeply needed fresh air is coming into these conversations from these sources.
And you're helping to bring that forward with your book. I read your book, so it's funny how in this discipline, in this subject matter, it feels like we've read each other's books before we have. It's a very weird thing, and that's a part of the phenomena too, is that you have these precognitive and these connections. I read Jeff Kripal's book after I wrote my book, Falling from Trees. I read The Flip, and I wrote to Jeff and I said, I feel like I read your book before I wrote mine, but I didn't. And he says, this happens all the time. So I think that's an interesting thing. There's this zeitgeist, there's this unconscious communication, there's this need for it. There's a recognition of how these pieces connect. Strength in numbers. So the more we come together, and I think this is all for good purposes. And the folks I've met in this on my path here have been wonderful and great new friends and intellectual stimulation and but nice people too.
Yeah,
So it's
absolutely.
been a great journey.
I'd love to, I think to sort of start, I'd love to know more about your path and about what sort of brought you here. This book, For All We Know, is a novel. It reads very much like an autobiography. It's very well written as a novel. The character of Mateo is very believable, and I can really sort of
Thank
see it
you.
in his eyes. But I assume that there's a lot of elements of his story that might have some origins in your own story. So I'd love to know a bit more about your sort of personal sources of inspiration and just sort of your own
Sure.
journey through these topics through the years.
Sure. I'll just take a little step back. My writing. So you read my titles. I love when people read the titles and they kind of giggle a little bit and Freud's haberdashery habits. Just to briefly talk about that. So I'm a journalist. I've done a lot of music journalism, but not just and only. And the journalism has led me into having conversations with super interesting people that have, I would say, triggered some deeper interest in subject matter. So specifically, I was doing interviews with indigenous artists. And the whole way that that evolved was just pure magic. It does follow up. I will lead up into this. I was at a friend's studio. He's an artist in Brooklyn, and he does using metro cards. He cuts out metro cards and makes portraits, and they're stunning and beautiful. But he uses it's very scientific. He uses microscopes and things. Anyway, I'm in his studio. I've been there many, many times, and there's a portrait of. It's a beautiful portrait, and it's I don't know who the man is, but I know it's an indigenous person because he Carlos had been doing them. He's half Guatemalan and has indigenous origins. So when I asked him what this portrait was, he said, "Oh, that's Ernie Panicoli," and then he told me who Ernie was. Ernie was born in Brooklyn. He's of Cree origin. He's half Italian. And he was a photographer, the photographer for these major hip hop artists who trusted him, with their doing their portraits. Anyway, I met Ernie, talked with him. I did an interview. The interview published. I would say I did about 10 interviews. For me, it was an education, Eric, to talk to people who, I mean, almost instantly, there may be a hesitance to talk to someone who's not indigenous. And I understand that given history. But it launched a kind of a deep interest in the subject matter. I read tons of books on, very specific books, Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And these things kind of launched an interest in the philosophy, the metaphysics that link mind to nature. I think the Apache word, and I know Apache is not the appropriate word anymore, but the word for mind is the same word for land. So these interesting things. So anyway, that launched that reading and those interviews got me connected very magically to Peter Rowan. And it's a long series of connections. I actually met a woman. Ernie had said, "Oh, you need to meet this woman, Yongchin Lamo, and interview her, but take care of her." And Ernie's like a big guy from Brooklyn, so you're like, "Yeah, I promise. Of course I will." But he knew I would. And Yongchin is an incredible musician. I urge you to go out and check her music.
Oh, I know her music.
Oh, you know it. Okay, great. You know it. She's become a dear friend. And she introduced me to Peter, because I saw that she played with Peter. And that launched the book Mescalito Riding His White Horse, which in many ways kind of was the. I do a lot of reading when I'm writing. And when I'm doing that reading, it kind of then inspires other ideas and integrating other topics. So I think I read like 30 books for that one little book. And I found Jeff Kripal's book, The Flip. And I probably read, gosh, my wife will. Kill me with the amount of books that are streaming in.
Yeah, I'm the same.
You know what? You know,
It's very upsetting.
you get that hassle, I mean, forget the guitars. I have like six guitars, there's that too. So because you asked me, well, what's the origin of this book and what inspired this book? I have a philosophy degree, undergraduate. So I'm very interested in philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, and a master's in English. But I think I come at the subject, at the ufology subject, in a very philosophical way. So, as you saw in the book, it's written, I wanted it to feel like memoirs. I wanted it to read like a personal story. I also didn't want it to be on the nose UFO story. So some will not like that because they want elements of a UFO story, but some will resonate with the philosophical subjects. It's not a philosophical book, but it does wouldn't it it's touches on philosophical ideas, but it's not written like philosophy is what I'm trying to say. So you'll see in that book there is I'm touching on near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. I'm touching on psychedelic experiences, dreams. So all of these subjects, kind of the interdisciplinary subjects that we're now seeing that they're cohering. I wanted to put that in this story to make it, frankly, to make it relatable to people who might not pick the book up. It is a work of literature. I don't write on spec, so my hope is some people will pick up a book and it says UFO and I'll put it down. Oh, this is, I'm not going to read this stuff. I'm hoping it touches those people. And I'm hoping also that, the ufology field is a wide spectrum from, nuts and bolts to people that are into the more philosophical aspects of it. And of course, you have everything in between. So, Diana Pasulka's work, Whitley Strieber's work, Joshua Cutchin's work, that Jack Hunter's work, those things I had read and they fed into the thesis of the book, which I think you can say is as above, so below. There's a lot of terrestrial, there's a lot of ecology in the book, which is why when I saw your interview with Jack, I said there's a lot of convergence here. We probably should talk. I did want, because from my perspective, and I'm not fixed on any of these ideas. It's not like I have a firm and I'm, going to go to battle for these ideas. I'm open to the fluidity of where this goes. I'm of the opinion that, looking in here is looking out there, and they are very much connected.
It's all fascinating. I will say, I will come back to music in a minute, but the Peter Rowan connection is something that I didn't realize existed until a couple of weeks ago when we had already scheduled this podcast, because I've known Peter for quite a few years. We've met many times at Tarramandala, which is actually where I think he did the concert with Yongchen Lamo, which is a Buddhist retreat center in Colorado that I started going to when I was 14 years old, still very involved with. Peter, his music is incredible. He's also an incredibly interesting and lovely man.
Yes.
I really appreciate him as an individual and also really love his music. So I loved seeing that connection with a whole book that's really based on interviews that you did with him. So people should definitely go check that book out as well, and also Peter's work. But coming back to Jack Hunter, he describes your book as, quote, a literary excursion into the lived experience of the UFO phenomenon, interwoven into a tapestry of music, psychedelics, and the flux and flow of everyday life. And he says that it provides the reader with, quote, a biographical snapshot of the processes by which anomalous experiences are perceived, processed, and incorporated into a personal perspective on the cosmos and the human condition. I think this is a really excellent sort of synopsis of what the book is really doing. With Jack's work and works that he's been involved with, things like Greening the Supernatural, or sorry, Greening the Paranormal.
Paranormal. Yeah.
There's really this sort of approach to UFOs where they're mentioned from a more or less animistic kind of perspective, with really, as you just said, sort of minimal preconceptions about the origins or the precise nature of the phenomenon, rather just sort of taking it as an extraordinary experience or something that is paranormal in some extent that can really feed into other experiences that are also extraordinary. And that's really, this book for me, when you're talking about it's sort of, there are UFOs in it, and you talk about UFOs in it quite a bit, but your use of that term and of sort of approaching the phenomenon is quite unique, I think, and a bit creative. It seems like really it's sort of an exploration of enchantment in its grandest sense, this mystical experience of really being in relationship with an other or witnessing an other, and that sort of spark of magic that arises from that. But as you know, and also speaking to the sort of the dance that you were just talking about, where in some part it's for those that may not be drawn to a book that is about UFOs. And Mateo also notes this in the book. He says that I don't remember the precisely what he said, but something to the effect of, people might be more comfortable with this sort of technological explanation for extraordinary experiences. We have this tendency because we are technological and we live in a sort of context in which technology is the answer to a lot of sort of quandaries. It's easiest for people to jump to that as the sort of rational conclusion. There's also the other side of that, where there's folks that are really turned off to the idea of UFOs, especially when they're really heavily couched in the sort of extraterrestrial theory. So it's interesting. I feel like this book almost acts as a kind of bridge between those that are sort of predisposed to more mainstream extraterrestrial kinds of discourse and those that are more interested in the deeper spiritual and philosophical ideas, which sometimes intersect and often don't. This is quite different than the sort of ancient aliens kind of theories that you find, with where folks try to reduce everything extraordinary and spiritual and magical to extraterrestrial, hyper technological civilizations from some distant planet. This is completely different, but it still exists at that sort of intersection, I think, in a really fruitful way.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, 'cause that truly was the goal. The title is For All We Know. And so that's it's really a questioning. It's casting about. You'll notice that Mateo is, I intentionally made Mateo a kind of, he lacks knowledge. He's exploring, he's learning. We know more than he does. We see his naivete. We're more aware of it than he is, and he becomes aware over time. But I wanted, he doesn't win the arguments. His PhD friend, who's a kind of materialist, traditional materialist, I felt it wouldn't be fun to have him win the arguments. I wanted him to feel, I wanted people to feel relate to him, and to him not to possess all the answers. It's interesting, Bernardo Castro has written a book about the absurd, and but that was a while ago. I think he wrote it in 2012. But to your point that, 19th century, in the 19th century, science became so powerful and effective. And you look at the great leaps that we've made since then, and most of academia is flooded with that kind of materialist a perspective. I do find it interesting when you come up against it. It's interesting when you come up against a strict materialist, you're almost automatically categorized in like religious terms. So if in philosophy of science, I read a book called Is Evolution a Construct? It's not an anti-evolution book. What it looks at is the different scientists in their context. So you take, for example, you look at, it's written by Michael Ruse. You look at Darwin, writing during the Industrial Revolution, survival of the fittest, and where he's coming from. And then you look at someone I'm sure you're familiar with, Lynn Margulis, who had the idea of coevolution, sort of, she was involved in the Gaia theory and the development of that with James Lovelock. But where she's coming from is, let's all be together and let's all make this work, kind of coevolution, which was laughed at when she published it and is now very much taken seriously. And these are to my point that, science is a moving target. It's a very powerful, we get powerful tools and models that are effective until they aren't. And we shouldn't ride those. Science becomes religion for people, and people defend it with the same fervor as they do a religion. And I feel we should keep those flaps a little open and a little bit more fluid, Bernardo Castro kind of, I wouldn't say he looks at the idea of materialism, and it's sort of materialists feel they have one up on the universe. I gotcha, I know now, I know we've figured it all out, and people aren't comfortable with uncertainty. And I think the UFO subject is an exploration of the limits of knowledge. It the way I'm coming at it's very much an exploration of the definitions of consciousness. I'm not, arguing from any perspective that people see things. There's no doubt about it. And we have multiple modalities of data, infrared, radar, eyewitness testimony from trained observers. So there's something afoot. But what's interesting about it too, and why the psychological comes in, and I try to weave that into the book, is there's an intentional component of all of this. There's some intentionality. So when Fravor, is that the pilot's name? He was seeing this object, the tic-tac object. My son makes fun of me because I've called it the tick-tock, and he says, "No, Dad, it's tic-tac." I'm like, "Oh, that's right, that's right." So when he was seeing it, he sees this object move 85,000 miles an hour in 3 seconds. But he also saw there's something that pilots have, they call it a cap point. And a cap point is a, I guess, an agreed upon position. So, when the stuff hits the fan, we know this point, this is our safety point, or somehow means that. The tic-tac showed up in the cap point, which is highly unusual, as if to say, "I know what you're thinking." So that's the aspect of this phenomena. It seems to be involved with us somehow. Jung felt that it was, I think Jung had different positions on it. He felt it was purely psychological, but then I think he came around to, well, there's also something else going on as well. So that's what really interests me is, we live in a 15 billion year old universe. We think the Earth is about 5 billion years old. There are 6 septillion stars. We in the visible universe, there are 2 trillion planets, we believe, in the visible universe. How could there not be life in the universe? I mean, it's so Ptolemaic. It's not even like Copernican. This is to think that this is all here for us. It doesn't sound scientific.
No, it's, I mean, this is something that I've talked about a lot. It's a fundamentally anthropocentric sort of argument. For me, I'm quite interested in the prospect that, these sort of UFO phenomena are terrestrial. That's an area that I think is really underappreciated, especially since the vast majority of sightings have taken place within the Earth's atmosphere. I think nearly all of them have taken place within the Earth's atmosphere, even if they are aerial, which begs the question of, why should we assume that they come from somewhere else? Though it would make absolute sense that they could come from somewhere else for precisely what you just said. But there is that element of, with the sort of materialist, the sort of old materialist perspective, which is intrinsically disenchanted, which is really in opposition to the, what some people are calling sort of new materialism, that's really allowing for more of a confluence of the sort of materialist, ontological frameworks with some space for enchantment and meaning and, something not necessarily greater than the material, but recognizing that material itself is greater. We are material, we ourselves are physical embodied beings, and yet we know firsthand what it's like to be a physical embodied being, and we would have a very difficult time reducing our physicalness or our beingness to this, strictly sort of inert, physical process. We know that there's more in that experientially. And I find it interesting, you talk about like Darwin I mean, the Darwinian evolution should have completely changed our entire approach to philosophy. It should have really had a much more dramatic impact on our sort of philosophy of the mind and philosophy of consciousness. But that really hasn't taken place until quite recently. You know, simply recognizing that all biological life forms on this planet are our kin, including, you know, gut bacteria that live inside of us and you know, all the various microorganisms that make up the microbiome, in addition to all the plants and animals and fungi and so on. That's world altering. And, you know, just simply recognizing that, I think creates a lot of space for enchantment to exist in the space of materiality and really seeing that the material is still enchanted. We don't have to accept the sort of wager of disenchanted modernism that suggests that n quote, so-called nature is disenchanted. There's no reason to accept that. And it is one of the things that I really like about sort of UFO paradigm specifically, because these aren't like wispy spirits. They aren't, you know, something that's entirely in the mental domain. They're physical things that people see and record, and that we have some degree of data suggesting, you know, that they actually exist. It's something that is in the material sort of dimension, and yet it's obvious for anyone that's experienced them, it seems, and for those that study them, that there's way more to it than just this strictly sort of materialistic, is sort of instrumentalist, inert, you know, domain. There, it's enchanting. You know, it's like science is enchanting. The real world is enchanting. We don't have to completely separate ourselves from it in order to find enchantment and to find meaning. We can also find it in our own bodies and in the bodies of others and in the phenomena that we experience in the living world.
And I completely agree with what you said. And I think it also has implications. So there's metaphysics behind it. There's the metaphysics have a kind of, let's say, ethical implications. So when you look at you look at your having the human experience, the human being is continuous with the planet, that we are part of the ecology. We are a part of, I mean, we're made up of water, soil, and air, where everything that we consume is a part of that, and we're connected to that. And somehow materialism, I think it cuts people off from that. It cuts people off from the notion of being connected to, being a part of. We are not above the earth and the I mean, we have a lot of control. Technology has, well, it appears to have given us a lot of control. But there's a fear. I think there's a fear that humans want to feel like we are dominant, we are running things. And it's rife throughout academic literature, throughout scientific literature, that disenchantment. You know, I've mentioned on other podcasts, there's a book called, I've read Steven Weinberg's books. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics. He has a book called The First 3 Minutes. Interesting book. Then he has a book called Dreams of a Final Theory. And I thought, and that book probably came out 30 years ago. I don't remember, but it's trying to connect the quantum theory with general theory of relativity. And there's this, we're not able to bridge it. And, you know, I'm sure Steven Weinberg is a lot smarter than I am. He has won the Nobel Prize in Physics. That to me is not a very wise title for a book. Why would we think that we'd come, you know, we're thinking beings for 30,000 years, using, you know, language and tools in the way that we, you know, modern humans do. That's a blip. That's like a drop in the ocean of time. Why would we think that now we possess this ultimate, the answers to everything? We have dreams of a final theory.
I mean,
I
we
think
all
it's in.
it's every generation ends up thinking that we finally figured it out and we finally arrived at the absolute conclusion, and then we just discover that that's not the case. You talk actually about is it Thomas Kuhn's the structure of
Scientific revolution.
yeah, and it, you know, it's really that tends to be our tendency. And it's that I think the difficulty for especially laymen to sort of understand that there is a difference between science as a process, the scientific method, and the ever-evolving nature of, increasing scientific knowledge versus the sort of philosophies that come out of science and then are sort of codified as true for a certain amount of time. And it does create this kind of filter where you always have these little periods of time in which anything that strays outside of the norm that had been established at one point a little while ago, it just gets filtered out and tossed to the side. And then eventually something happens, there's a revolution of sorts, and we find out, oh, actually, that old filter was wrong. Let's place a new one here. Sorted, we got it. And then we do the same exact thing over and over and over again. And it really blinds us to new information, not forever, because we usually, in some ways, come around to it and realize, oh, actually, we were super wrong about that. But it takes us some time, and we're not in any different sort of a situation today. We still do the exact same thing. And there's a lot of information, there's a lot of science that is coming from the sciences and from research that we allow to just be discarded as bathwater because we don't yet have a sort of scientific, paradigm that can accommodate its existence. And I think that's really why there needs to be more, sort of, more collaboration and communication and more flexibility between the sciences and philosophy and the humanities and with the arts, because that's really where we get this sort of, plasticity that allows us to recognize, like, we don't know everything. We don't at all know everything. We know a lot, but we don't know everything, and we're super wrong about some fundamental things. So how can we stretch our brains and our perceptions to be able to accommodate these abnormalities and these, unusual, extraordinary things, without, collapsing it into one category or the other of, absolute nonsense and just sort of facts don't matter versus only the things that we've established as true in the past 100 years are valuable. It's tricky, but I think it's important.
There are things we don't understand. So
Right.
Bernardo Castro has written a number of excellent books on philosophy. He's a philosopher. And the idea that we're uncomfortable not knowing for sure. And I think that's what, the UFO subject matter, it goes right to the heart of why are we here? What is consciousness? What is the mind? What are the limits of knowledge and science? So when these high strangeness things occur, and they occur throughout the world and have occurred throughout time, and you hear similar stories in, I was reading Artie Clark. She's an indigenous writer. I think she's an educator at Montana State University, but she's indigenous. She went out into the field, and she speaks Spanish. She went to South America and parts of Spanish-speaking indigenous, the Spanish-speaking indigenous world, and interviewed people. And I think the name of the book is one of the books is Star People, but they have these, they're UFO stories. They're stories of someone coming out of nowhere, appearing, or it could be from an orb of light, or it's very similar to UFO stories. And they have their problems with admitting that, and with that has its own series of problems as well for people. You're on a reservation. There's a lot of instability to admit something like this. It's not necessarily an open discussion, but it is something that the shamans of those cultures accept and believe. Shamans across cultures accept and believe. But I think for modern Western Americans, gigantic, huge, some making a generalization, it upsets the apple cart a bit of the Tao and the 9 to 5, the everyday, and picking up the kids from school, buying a car, and it's unsettling. I had a friend that said something. We were talking about the infinity, the largeness of space, And she said, that really makes me nervous. It makes me anxious when you talk about it. And I said, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, but people are uncomfortable, some people with uncertainty. And where this takes us to is a place of frankly, of we're not sure. For all we know, we don't know what these phenomena are. We know that they exist. We know people experience them, and in different ways. So they experience them, as Jacques Vallée had discovered or written about, and has since been written about a lot. We experience the phenomena according to our context. It may have been a chariot. It may have been a balloon. It becomes a spaceship. It could be a ghost, or it could be a fairy. So it's sort of it really comes according to the context of knowledge that we have, which is fascinating in itself. And what's interesting is you connect it to, we're learning what we have learned in quantum mechanics, that consciousness is bound up in that inextricably and fascinating. So the materialist says there's that world out here and there's this world in here. But really, that world out there is made up from this world in here. That's Bernardo Castro's, his what does he call it? Idealism. He calls it idealism, so that we construct. I mean, it's Jung's idea too, and they weren't the first people to think of it. We construct the world from in here, from our. It doesn't exist independently of how we create it, which is an interesting perspective. We don't see the thing in itself.
Right. It seems that we struggle to acknowledge that others are also engaged in that process from their side of things. Especially, coming back to this sort of idea of anthropocentrism, this is one of the things that I do tend to find in, the sort of approaches to UFOs and these kinds of experiences, which tend to really take the extraterrestrial sort of technocentric approach for granted. It often stinks of anthropocentrism to me. Because a lot of times, I think for a lot of people, in fact, they might be more willing to acknowledge that life, like conscious life, exists on other planets than they are to recognize that conscious life exists in my room with my cat over
Right,
there.
my garden, yeah,
Yeah,
right
exactly.
here, right now.
Yeah, there was an article I wrote. I don't remember what for Watkins magazine. It was based on an article that I read on this in Scientific American. Couple of years ago, that was called like "Are We Alone?" And there was a comment in it, something to the effect of like, it would seem preposterous to think that humans are the only life forms in the universe. And this was said completely earnestly, missing entirely the fact that we are not the only life forms on this,
Right.
in my body or in this
Right.
room or, certainly on this planet. But there is this kind of blindness that we tend to have because we have a predisposition in some cultural and social contexts, in the modern world especially, to think that humans are the only meaningfully alive sentient beings on this planet. So then we're constantly searching for other kinds of intelligent life forms. And once upon a time, we looked around us in our own world for other forms of life, whether seen or unseen, that we were in communion with. But now, after having made it through this sort of, cognitive, evolution, devolution, perhaps into this anthropocentric worldview, we think that, well, our only option is to look out there. We have to look,
Right.
Millions of light years away into other worlds for something that looks like us. And that's the only place that we'll find intelligent life. Or today, perhaps also artificial intelligence. That's the other sort of, interesting wild card that's been thrown onto the table is that, I think there's quite a few people who are more willing to accept that ChatGPT is sentient than they are to recognize that a pig is sentient. And
Right.
I think that's quite problematic and horrifying and confounding, but it really just speaks to what you were just saying about, it's based on our own current working sort of context and our own current theories about things and about the ways that things work and our own values fundamentally. Right now, we value technology and we value humanness in modern, so-called Western, so-called, sort of, modernist society. But that hasn't always been the case, and it's not the case universally today. And hopefully it's not the case forever. We need to go beyond that, if especially we're going to deal with the ecological crises that we're facing.
Yeah, interesting that we're more of a host to other beings in our bodies than we are our, all just human cells, interestingly. And to speak of intelligence, it's just beginning to turn spring here. So I think it was over a week ago or so, I walked out, and in Brooklyn we have there are a couple of parks, and we have a quite a variety of tree types and bird types. And the plethora of bird sounds now streaming in, all of that rich intelligence and all of the intelligence that happens in the interplay between species and that interwoven kind of what Lynn Margulis talks about. Fascinating. There's so much intelligence around us, and we just look up in a telescope, and in a way, you wonder, well, if they're, if they're out there, why aren't they talking to us? Maybe we haven't passed the test. I mean, look at the condition of the planet right now and the state that we're in, the turmoil. And as much potential as we have, we're a problematic species. And you think, would I necessarily talk to a squirrel? I think you should. In the book, you probably read, so I talk to trees. And once you sort of begin to pay attention, and nothing new to you, I know from your work, once you begin to pay attention, there's something, they're talking back. There's something going on. And I don't know what it is. But, there are, again, these are ideas that have been across culture, across time. What is it? The Australian miracle makers, I think they're called the Kiraji. I don't know if I say it right, but they're capable of are capable of fast travel, clairvoyance. They're immune to fire. Kind of fascinating. Alexandra David Neal, she's studied the Tibetan, went to Tibet. You have shamans that can,
With a
is that can.
lot that she falsified, to be fair. She wasn't the
Oh,
most
okay.
reliable, but
Yeah.
still important work.
The ideas are not hers alone, but the ability to bilocate. These are they there are no, I don't think there's a word in Tibetan for paranormal. Maybe you know more than I do about that. Is there?
No, because the idea of normal is subjective. It's the same with,
Exactly.
no word for supernatural in any non-Western language, because there's no word for nature, as in like the out there nature,
Right.
in any non-European language, because that was really an Enlightenment era sort of construct. We had the
Right.
word nature meaning something that is natural or inborn, but the idea that that place out there that humans go visit sometimes, or that we use for resources, that that's called nature, is a completely sort of relatively modern construct. So it's
Right.
really difficult, when people talk about like sort of cultural ecologies or like ecological and environmental philosophies and other cultures, we have to, first take a step back and look at our own presuppositions and where they come from, and recognize that they're not the baseline of reality. That's just the sort of quote unquote European sort of perspective. And this has been a bit of an evolution more recently, is like trying to get past this idea of a hyper real Europe, where, the ideas that we think are logical and rational and absolutely true, a lot of those presuppositions are just cultural conditioning that we haven't really examined. So then when we try to look at so-called subaltern cultures or alternative ways of looking at the world, alternative ontologies, we tend not to recognize that. And then it just becomes a, oh, look at these neat beliefs that these other people have versus our science and our philosophy. And really, that's not how it is, especially when we talk about something like, quote unquote, nature. It's really, it's an absurd idea when we really get down to it. But yeah, that's a long way of answering. No, there isn't a single term at all to refer to those things. There's words for, magic and enchantment. There's words for many different words for spirits. But generally, there's no single catch-all term. There's a bunch of different, sort of types and subtypes and sub-subtypes that are used. But it's a lot more complex because the understanding of the world was a lot more nuanced and dynamic than ours tends.
Right. As a, and I think on some level the word paranormal it's a kind of a loaded term. And what I do in the book, and for all we know, is I write about things that are very very in a sense mundane. Some of it, it's very mundane, very terrestrial. Did you want to say something? It sounded like you had a
I had a whole a set of questions about that specifically because I
please,
really
please.
liked that. You t the chapter titles sort of indicate a certain amount of this. It's like I don't remember what they were specifically, but like there's a sort of a church is a UFO or tree is a UFO or I am the UFO, etc. But I really, really appreciated that. Because we can talk about, of course, the extraordinary mystical experiences that are had in different religious traditions and spiritual traditions and great yogis and shamans and lamas, so on. But I really appreciated that this was a lot more imminent. It was a lot more immediate and mundane, expressing itself, these moments of enchantment that arise not only in sort of the normal, but even things that we might look at a bit sort of pejoratively. We might, deem to be bad in certain ways. Everything from, violence to drug use to, sort of conventional religion to I mean, sex and relationship, like there's all kinds of different things that are gateways, sort of portals to experiences of enchantment in the book. I really liked that. Even gambling, the gambling bit I found fascinating. It's just recognizing that these certain areas of human experience that we think of as being so trivial and so sort of base can themselves be, for some people, a sort of gateway into an experience of, the sort of numinous or of, something greater than themselves or other than themselves.
Well, I mean, if you were here, I would give you a big hug because this is what I was really trying to go for, and to make it very relatable. As the character has a gun put up to his head, and there's a kind of the intense power of that to shift consciousness and to put you into a different state. Or watching someone watching his mother die, and that kind of the liminal, states where something magnificent is happening, something completely transcendent, but it's also very ordinary because this is everyday stuff. Listening to music, even in of course, there's the psychedelic experiences as well in the book, and I did put them there for a reason. I think I started writing for the psychedelic press about, I don't know, 5 years, 6 years ago. Have you read their any of their journals?
No, but I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, and actually, it's my it's that's become a big bridge to my UK connections. Jack being among them, but not only. There's a bunch of people I'm in contact with, but that is a portal. That is a portal. Like Aldous Huxley felt, it's not, you don't want to just stay there in that place. But as a Westerner in a modern technological society that is like an anvil to your, whole sense of ontology, just crashing it. And I wanted to, it seems a little playful in there. I did want the book to have humor too. I wanted it to have, to be funny. I thought it was funny parts of it. I was laughing. Because I wanted there to be room for ideas to breathe and for room for the characters to be wrong, to be incomplete in their knowledge, like we are. But I was very inspired a long time ago by Terence McKenna and his, fascinating ideas he wrote early on about the connection between psychedelics and ufology. And there are shamans who they would take the ayahuasca and then throw vomit it on rock surfaces and basically use that as a kind of space-time portal, interestingly. And it reminds me of Carl Sagan, I forget the other scientist's name, but they came up with the level three societies. So level one, two, three. Level three can harness the power of the core of galaxies to re-engineer space-time. And so to me, there's that convergence of it's a portal, and I'm not promoting the use of anything. But interestingly, John Hopkins, Berkeley, NYU, if you've had an encounter with an extraterrestrial on a psychedelic plant, they're very interested to talk to you. So this has caught other people's attention as well. And it's done playfully, but anyone approaching these things should have humility and respect, and they're very powerful tools. They are tools.
And
But again, pardon?
beings,
And beings, right?
especially when it
Yes,
comes
yeah.
to things like, mushrooms as opposed to, something synthetic like LSD. And that's something that I think you touch on really nicely in the book. It's become a bit of a litmus test for me when people talk about psychedelics. It's sort of, when the beingness of the especially organic organisms that are being sort of, used in this context, when they're objectified and instrumentalized, I always feel it sort of turns me off and it raises a red flag for me. But I think, for you, there is in the book, there was really a sense of sort of recognizing the presence of mushrooms specifically as living agents in a process of relationship, sort of imparting knowledge or sharing perspectives. You said specifically, quote, the character says, quote, "I know this is the mushroom giving me a glimpse into the inner life of the apartment and its cosmic history, how each particle in the wall was formed, its journey since its inception inside of a star billions of years ago," which really resonated a lot with me. But I really appreciate that. And there were many other points where, it's sort of acknowledging the beingness of the mushroom, in addition to the experience that it's sort of imparting, but without robbing it of its own agency. I really appreciated that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Terence McKenna felt that they were kind of, the mushrooms were kind of using us on some level, but it's a little bit symbiotic, but using us to spread its seed and to go other places. He also felt that the mushrooms had something to do with the evolution of consciousness. Interesting, which I think I don't know if anyone's proven him wrong. But I'm glad you noticed those things, and they're subtle. So I didn't want to approach this as it's a teaching, or I wanted it to come across as ideas, and ideas people can relate to, that it's readable. Do you know Earl Grey Anderson? He's
D. Earl Grey.
His real name is Earl Grey Anderson, and he's involved with MUFON, and he comes from the kind of, I would say he comes from that. That's not where he is now, the nuts and bolts UFO background. But he read the book and said, it's a new, I feel it's a new kind of literature. It's like a UFO literature. And I don't mean to say that to kind of, pat myself on the back, but yeah, I was aiming for literature. I was aiming for subtlety. I was aiming to engage the ideas without hitting you over the head with them. So all what you're saying is music to my ears. In fact, there's a lot of music in the book, you'll notice.
There is, and I actually wanted to touch on that. I wanted to come to music next. But I just wanted to share one bit that I really liked, because the acknowledgement of the personhood of non-humans, especially non-animal beings, especially animals, but also non-animal beings, is very important to me. And just as you did with the fungi, there was also really that sensitivity towards trees, especially. I love the attention that trees get in the story. I think it's really important that we involve trees in our narratives and that we acknowledge their beingness, as co-inhabitants of our world and co-creators of the stories that we're living. But there was a great bit where a tulip poplar tree named Fiddle recites a sort of sings a melody, which I also really liked, feeds into the music very nicely, to the protagonist, and sings, quote, "You humans are obsessed with your own narrow concerns. You don't see the living beings around you, the birds, the trees, and the insects. You don't feel the life that is pulsing everywhere. Just like you, we have lives. We have sorrows and joys, but we also comprehend our connection to the soil, to the animals that feed on us, to the insects that try to kill us, to the fungi, sometimes friend, sometimes foe. Even the rocks have life in them, and so we wait for you to wake up." I absolutely loved that. It's such a great little sort of
Thank you.
encapsulation of the animistic spirit. And really, I love specifically the, sometimes friend, sometimes foe part of that, because I think especially in sort of, we could say comfortably, sort of new age sort of approaches to spirituality specifically, there's a tendency to sort of lose that nuance and turn it into either the sanctification of nature, the deification of trees and plants and non-humans, sort of throwing beings into these binarized categories of good and evil. But that's really not how the world works. That's not how so-called nature works. We're in relationship with one another. Sometimes those relationships are friendly, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're violent, sometimes they're, totally amicable. It really just depends on circumstance. And I think this message from the poplar is really quite on point in that regard.
Well, thank you for that. And these are, all with intention. You probably can feel Merlin Sheldrake dripping from all of
Of
that.
course.
So thank you, Merlin.
Yeah.
But not just and only, there was a that was a road, a path of learning, of discovery. And you'll notice that the character starts out, he's a city kid. I mean, of course, there's this is there are aspects of me in there for sure, some based on real experiences, but not limited to. But that character is skeptical, doesn't trust, is untrusting of characters who come into his life. And, on to your point, you can encounter people that have, maybe they're not completely trustworthy, yet they have something powerful to offer. And there's that instability and that it's not binary. Nature, we have hurricanes, that do horrible things to all life on the planet. I could go on the myriad of things that occur. We approach it just from our perspective. We don't understand we don't understand what's going on in the bigger picture. But it's understandable why we would be concerned. Our very lives are at stake, and the threat of what it can do, the power of nature. So I really love that. I'm so appreciative that you're hitting on the points that some folks may, in the UFO world may look at and say, well, what does this have to do with UFOs? And I think it has right in the center heart of the conversation.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of music by intention.
Yeah.
So I'm a music journalist. So I'm deep interest in music, music history, musicology. Music is a powerful tool. There's music coming from everywhere,
Yeah.
from, crickets rubbing their limbs together, birds, obviously, complex harmonies. There are birds that duet, and you'll hear rapid fire kind of duetting, and the harmonies that they can sing that are learned. There's music of pulsars. There's vibrations happening. There are vibrations happening everywhere. The universe is very noisy, but we create music to kind of control time, to create mood. It becomes its own way of navigating consciousness, experience. You hear music, it may remind you of someone or a time. All ceremonies, rituals are accompanied by music. I read this book, The Healing Drum. It's by Yaya Diallo. And it's interesting, the role of the drummer in that book is a healer. And it's taken very, very seriously. It's a spiritual path. And there are different musics that are used for different purposes. So even in working, there's music, so it may conform to the music. Well, you're doing something like shoveling, or you're doing agriculture, and you'll hear there's an unex and a miss not yet well enough understood knowledge of the origins of music. I'm very interested in that and its power. I'm a musician, deeply interested in music, but it's on many levels. Just the sounds themselves as being transformative. It doesn't even have to be strictly music. Binaural beats, for example.
And it certainly doesn't have to be that elevated sort of culturally. You know, I think that's the interesting aspect of it is it can also be one of those very sort of mundane spaces, you know, depending on who you ask, where enchantment and inspiration can really arise. You know, as you said, it's no accident that music takes a really central role in religion and in ritual. It's really effective at creating that sort of experience of elevation. It's also really effective at creating group cohesion and bonding. But we usually don't, you know, look for those powers again, depending on who you are, in, you know, like rock or bluegrass or heavy metal or pop. You know, these are, you know, things that, you know, certain folks especially tend to be very sort of dismissive of in their capacity to really instill any kind of genuine, you know, spiritual or elevational kind of experience. But it's there. It's very much there. It's profoundly there. I read something recently, I don't remember who said it, but someone who was theorizing that, you know, like they think that one of the reasons why sort of religious fundamentalism is calls to certain people so much, especially as you find in like, you know, American evangelicalism and things, is because people don't go to live music enough. They don't go clubbing. They don't go dancing. They don't go to experience the ecstasy of music. The only place that they feel they can actually let themselves go and fully embrace it is in a sort of, you know, religiously sanctioned sort of sacred context. And religious music can be incredibly, you know, transformative and powerful and beautiful and enchanting, especially older stuff. I won't say so much about like modern sort of, you know, mega church music. I hate that. But it's still, even that is tapping into the power of, you know, some of these really this sort of fundamental and almost mundane aspects of music that we might just completely look past, but they can be a portal into a completely different way of experiencing life and reality, a different way of viewing the world. You know, it creates an ambiance, it creates a sort of channel of existing that it accomplishes that in a way that I don't think anything else really can in quite the same way.
It's great points that you made. disco, even, four on the floor. Boom, 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 boom. Heartbeat, the drum beat is, there's an element of danger in it too. A drum beat, just being close to your heartbeat, can be used. You think of the fife and drums, how it's used in, how it has been used in Western music. And yes, all of the rhythmic power and what that could do, there's a lot to be explored there. I began reading about it, and some researchers and scientists think that music came before language. So you're in, you want to communicate to your group, your local group, and you could maybe during the hunt, or even just during when primates groom each other, they hum and make noises back and forth. There's communication, and then it's broadly distributed to other. When is it time to eat? Now it's time to eat. They use other communications, but it's song. It's interesting. Gorillas have eating songs, their favorite foods. There's something, we don't know why it's there. We don't know. So that's very much in the book too, is this the origins of music. Now I do it a little playfully too with a heavy metal concert, and King Diamond, man, that was interesting. But it is a little playful too. But we recognize the power of it and what that can release.
Mateo says in the book, quote, that music is, quote, the most important journey of a human soul, that music can transport you, deliver you, that music is a form of time travel. I loved that. There were a few other quotes on music that I did write down. Music is a form of magic. It's really, I think, incredibly true. I'm reminded also of the far north in Europe. I have one side of my family is largely Sami, so part of the Sami sort of indigenous group that lives in the far north of Scandinavia in Sapmi, which is now occupied by Sweden, Finland, Norway, and Russia. But they have a practice called yoiking, and yoiking sounds to many people to be quite similar to a lot of vocalizations that are used in Native American traditions, especially in North America. But it's and it is perhaps related even sort of prehistorically. But it's a part of this sort of animistic and somewhat shamanistic sort of ontology, where the yoik is really the song. The musical manifestation of an other, of a person or a human person or a non-human person, an animal, a tree, a locality, a place. And when that being is yoiked, it's really not so much that you're singing about them. It's that, someone, the person who's created the yoik, has sort of gained the ability to transform that being into a song, to find their song, the song that actually sort of encapsulates them as a person. And you can find this in some other Northern European traditions, in the Finnish and Karelian tradition. There's a great mythic corpus that was collected by Elias Lundrup called the Kalevala. And one of the characters in the Kalevala, Väinämöinen, he's the sort of eternal bard, this very shamanic figure who is the first man to come into that part of the world. And he sings the trees into existence and sings the animals and all the beings into existence. He's a favorite character of mine, and also a big influence on J.R.R. Tolkien, who I want to talk about in just a second. This is a very similar sort of understanding that's deep in our ancestral cultural memories, that song is magic. Music is this distinctly magical thing that has the ability to really call entire universes into existence. It isn't always something that's this very serious, churchy, perfect harmonies, choral kind of arrangement. It can be very different from that. Väinämöinen songs are often very sort of almost bubbly in a certain sense. We see this in Tolkien with Tom Bombadil, who I think is very closely related to Wainamoinen, where some of the most powerful songs of enchantment that he utilizes, they sound somewhat fun. They're not these like serious dirges. They're these fun songs that really capture the essence of the environment or other beings. And I think we can find this in pop music. In my book, I talk about Lorde. Ella Maria Laniella Tuokkonen, she's a New Zealand singer, goes by Lorde, one of my very favorite singer-songwriters, who's very much a pop artist, self-identified as a pop artist. But she did this great album right before Unseen Beings came out called Solar Power. And it was a total sort of left turn for her. She had done Royals and she had done this great album, Melodrama, which is one of the greatest pop albums of the century. I think it will remain that at the end of the century. But Solar Power was really, it came from a different space. And it was really sort of this emergent conversation between her and the more than human world, between her and her dog who passed away before it came out, which was a big grief for her, with her and, her sort of country of New Zealand, Aotearoa, and her relationship with the land, and I just found it incredibly moving. That album really means a lot to me. But it's a pop album, and this is the thing is, like, I think so many people they miss a lot of magic by thinking that these things that are popular or base or mundane can't also be profoundly enchanting and world altering. They can be. They are. Music is that.
I wrote down those n names. I'm gonna check that out. But you mentioned a number of things that I think are very interesting and found their way into the book. I think it's called Singing to the Plants. Stephen Bayer is the writer, and I don't know if I pronounce it right, the Icaros. The songs that are sung by the shamans. And if you read, Maria Sabina, and you read the powerful effect that those have, my wife and I went to, we went to an indigenous ceremony, and it was a San Pedro ceremony. And it was very profound, accompanied by music the whole time. There was the shaman who was very much like a poet. And creating a space for you here. Most of his talk was about love and the unity of our unity with the cosmos, with the plants, with the trees, with life, with non living matter. But then there was music throughout the whole thing, and you had drumming and singing. And wow, was that powerful. It took you on, it took me to a place of where my mother had been ill at that time. And when people become older and when they become ill, sometimes there's dementia associated with that. And she was very cantankerous. And just, I was always very good to her, but she could definitely challenge the limits of, okay, mom, I heard you. Yes, I'll take care of that. But it took me to a place of this exploration of compassion, of the feeling of the another. Took me into the heart of, and to find stretch for more kindness and more compassion. And as a Buddhist, compassion is one of these things that it's one of the most creative acts any human can achieve, to imagine the other, someone else, maybe someone you don't like even, or other beings, unseen beings, to expand that compassion. So that was an interesting journey, very much accompanied by music, by song, by drumming. But then all of that dropped away. You're in this kind of, the music is happening, and then suddenly it's like a spaceship. And but now it's like a garment that's fallen off of you, and you're just, you're in the midst of so wonderful stuff. But I'm gonna check that out. I was thinking Bjork as you were saying that kind of, In that way, kind of.
Absolutely.
It's funny that, in our hyper materialist culture, we crave transcendence. We cr crave in our we watch a film, science fiction or fantasy, our music. We're caught up in all of these things that we dismiss as, well, that's just a drama. That's just, a Disney or an animation or just music or just this. But it quenches that thirst we have. We spend most of our time in our ego thinking, we're really running the show here. But the ego is just, it's duped into thinking it's in control.
We're so convinced, and it behooves the powers that be to keep us under this sort of
Absolutely.
sense that, the sort of the physical world on one hand, but also the sort of social scaffolding that's been put in place that we've been stuck into, that this is the real world. And to want to get out of that is something that we have to sort of curtail. We have to convince people, no, you really shouldn't do that. And I think that's where a lot of the sort of pejorative connotations of escapism really come from. This is something that Tolkien talks about quite a bit in his great essay on fairy stories, which I always recommend that people read. He explains that, for him, there's three fundamental functions of fairy stories, which for him he uses a little bit broadly to refer to these like stories of enchantment, which are mythic in nature, but aren't necessarily of the same sort of heightened mythic caliber that you'll find in like Homer or, the Eddas or something. It doesn't have to be about gods. It doesn't have to be about these big giant things. And it doesn't have to be institutionally sanctioned. They're just these stories of enchantment. But he explained that the three functions are escape, recovery, and consolation. And for him, escape was really, it's escaping not from the real world, but from this sort of ontological shackles that we've stuck ourselves in or that we've been forced into, the iron bars of our sort of conventional instrumentalist materialistic reality. And there is a natural impulse in us to escape into the real world, to find that transcendence and that real sense of relationship and enchantment. But in order to do that effectively, we first have to recover. And that's the other thing that stories give us the capacity to do, these enchanting stories or myth in the sense of stories about something important. They allow us to recover a clear view of reality, to be able to see things the way that we're actually meant to see them, seeing other beings as others that we're in relationship with, as opposed to objects to use or just reflections of our own human condition or what have you. And then in doing this, we can come to a kind of consolation, the so-called happy ending, or that you can be that we find in good stories. But this is, I really hold that teaching close to my heart because I think that's something that we are really hungry for. We feel that in our core. We know that that's something that pulls on us that we're trying to find. But we are told repeatedly that that's not something that we should be doing. Important stories aren't about the non-human. Serious stories, serious drama is about human-centered affairs, the human condition, human relationships, jobs, money, even things like mortality, but things that only are sort of very insular and are about us. But the real stories that I think can actually transform our world and help us create genuine change are indeed the stories that stretch us beyond that and allow us to really take seriously the experiences of others. I think that's why fantasy specifically is so phenomenally important. But also science fiction can very effectively do that, especially when we get into these, multi-planetary sorts of narratives. It allows us to really get into some of those kinds of conversations, which are real conversations that we need to be having, today more than ever. But we often avoid doing that. And in doing so, to your point earlier, we rob ourselves of the ability to really cultivate empathy and compassion for the other. Stories, even if it's not some grand mythic, sort of fairy tale or
Charles Dickens,
precisely. I mean, it allows us that space to be able to really exercise the muscle that helps us really cultivate compassion meaningfully.
And exactly. And the certainly in the book is, it's not, I don't come out and say it directly, but this discovering, the sacred within and the enchantment is in conflict, like you said, with the corporations that ultimately, kind of have the major control, oil corporations, and pulling levers and controlling government. And the UFO path is also very much in the way of that. That to think that getting us out of our everyday kind of workaday, 9 to 5, making money, saving money, what's in your 401k, where you're going to college, all of this kind of stuff, it gets in, enchantment gets in the way of that machine.
Yeah.
And I don't come out and say it directly. I wanted to demonstrate it in action, but that's very much in the center thesis of the many ideas in the book. One thing I did want to mention too, because you talked about being at a church and the music, and it's a place where people can kind of, when you go to a bluegrass concert, bluegrass festival, it's great to see, and it's, just this is the fact, it's largely white people dancing and just kind of grooving and doing the noodle. But it's fun to see, just being not self-conscious and being relaxed and chilled out. You don't know whose politics or what, which is interesting in our time,
Yeah.
now, because that's so kind of in your face, everyone's politics and this kind of binary. We are us. We are, we're fighting each other. But yeah, this book, for all we know, is about that process of enchantment and the myriad ways that it can happen in the most mundane, even in the face of watching death.
Yeah.
The discovery of the continuity of this being or this person's connection to the earth and to this kind of revelation of the oneness, the interwoven, suffused with terrestrial elements, and then here you are back into the earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, which is, kind of cliched and so on. But that revelation to me of returning—I forget what—I think it's called the returning, that chapter. It's funny, I talked to someone a couple of days ago, and he said, read the book, and we talked, and he said, I never heard of you. And I said, it's okay, I've never heard of me, so it's no worries. The idea of that continuity, that invisible ribbon that tethers, and that also goes inward and outward. And like a Möbius strip, and it's the bridge that connects us all. So I think you read it with the eyes that I would have hoped, would and the heart that would read the book and take the main ideas. Did you laugh at all? Were you laughing at any points?
I did. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate having had the opportunity to read it because I definitely think, I don't, admittedly, I don't read a lot of fiction. I habitually read Tolkien. I read Tolkien endlessly. I have done for 25 years. So I'm always in the middle of something and I reread things over and over and over again because I've sort of established that, his legendarium is my mythic foundation, and I want to spend my life engaging with it in the same way that my ancestors may have engaged with a body of mythic knowledge that came to them. So I focus primarily on that. I do read other fiction, but that's the primary fiction that I read. And then I read a lot of nonfiction. constantly my life is filled with books that I
Yeah.
always get shit from my husband for.
Yeah.
I don't read a lot of fiction, and I don't think I've ever read any fiction that was sort of UFO based. So I certainly would have been one of those folks that might have seen it and just said, nope, not for me.
Right,
So I'm
right.
really glad that I did read it. I'm glad that I had the opportunity to have it sort of pointed out to me as something that I should read, because I do think that it's, like I said before, I think it's a bridge, between different, multiple different areas of the human experience and sort of proclivities and orientations. But I think it's all really designed to get us a little bit onto the same page and talking about some of the what I think are the most important questions facing humanity today. But in a way that's really allowing for enchantment and wonder and science and technology and, all of the other dimensions that you bring to the table, that they're all there, they're all on the page. You don't have to completely compartmentalize them. So I really like that. And
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'm a huge Tolkien fan as well.
You mentioned Lord of the Rings a few. I think there were three references. I did count them. There are three references. I was wondering what your experience with his work had been. He's a great example also with the music thing. I think he wrote the greatest cosmogenesis myth that I think has ever been developed, the Ainulindale, the music of the Ainur, where the gods or the demiurges sing the universe into existence. And music runs through every layer of his mythology. It's always present in a really sort of profound way. So music is, a big part of that. But there's many resonances, I think, between, the things that you're writing about and his work. So I'm curious, what's your
I read Tolkien when I was a kid, and but then I went back to reading him. I've probably read the trilogy at least maybe three times in my life. I read it when I was maybe 14, and I would say it became the subconscious basis for so much of how I would see the world and things I would write and be interested in. Then when my older son was about, I guess about 12 or so, and the movies came out. So before the movies came out, I got these encyclopedias to kind of walk him. Now what's happening is that happens is I'm getting super interested and he's kind of a little bit rolling his eyeballs and, okay, Dad, now we know who's really interested in this, but to sort of teach him and so that he could have greater context. So I reread them, I guess about 20-ish years ago, something like that. I don't remember. But I've also just loved the what is it, The Monster and the Critics about Beowulf.
Great essay.
In my master's in English, I and I think it kind of it was inspired somewhat by Beowulf, but then Jorge Borges is very interested in the Scandinavian mythology, the Edda, and he writes very succinctly, as only Borges can. He can write about the history of the universe in 2 pages, and it's meaningful and powerful. But that got me reading. And as you know, Tolkien was a scholar of all of this. So I read many of the epics and got into Viking literature, and it's, the beautiful, you can tell it's pre it was it's not affected by cause and effect, like sort of, Socratic thinking. There's it's shamanistic and dreamlike. A lot of the stories, they don't have this happened and that happened and this happened. They're sort of in this dream way, things can materialize out of nowhere. But yeah, I've long been and I did I name a character? Was there a Tolkien named the trees? There was Grok. Was it Grok? I forget what the names are. Fiddle and Grok, maybe.
I only caught the
But
there.
there's definitely.
No, good.
Yeah, just the descriptions of nature, which I loved,
And some
which
smoke
disappointed me in the
rings. I
movie.
don't like smoke rings as well.
Oh, that's right. There was one story maybe, and some of it's playing with it and teasing. I have there's one story. I don't even know if it's in that book, but it's meeting this guy Tom Turkey. I don't remember if it's in that book. Is it that it's in there? Okay, and I kind of making fun of him, but I'm also jealous of him and this kind of highly evolved, kind of person with all of the accoutrements of, and it's purposely silly, a little bit like hippie kind of accoutrements of the pipe and he has a slung over his shoulder kind of, his music instrument. I because I do think that it's fun to play with stuff and to we take things so seriously we forget to laugh at ourselves a little bit and each other in a kind way, in a kind way. In the UFO world, not a lot of funny stuff out there, so it would I think that was my son in back of me. It could use we could all use a little humor to leaven and ease the conversation and open our minds and hearts, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's, I mean, I could go on forever. It's, I think that to that point, I think that that is a really important part of it. And I think that ties in a lot of the things that I really appreciated about the book, including this sort of actually what Tolkien himself would call the ennoblement of the sort of simple things. You know, for him, this experience of fairy, of this, you know, the not fairies as in creatures, but fairy as in the realm or domain in which fairies have their being. It's really just, it's the experiential state of enchantment. And good fantasy, good storytelling that gets us into that experience, it's not the stories that have the most dragons and the most magic and the most, like, you know, magical wands and people flying around. It's not that. It's the stories that enable us to look at a mug of beer or a log on a fire or, you know, a cottage or a hill or a tree or a lake or a river in a fundamentally different way, in a way that really is invested with that enchantment and that magic, which is inherent in those things themselves that have been central to their perception throughout human history. And that really only in recent times, with the rise of this disenchanted approach to the universe, have we started to instrumentalize and devoid of any of that wonder. And I think that's, you know, something that can be grandiose. It can be, you know, sort of spiritual and elevated in, you know, some kind of classical way. But it can also be really immediate and really familiar and humorous and fun. We have to be able to bring that into the fullness of our being, because I think you see this in spirituality and religion the most, perhaps, is that there is this tendency that once you become an important spiritual, deep thinker sort of person, you lose any sense of humor, you lose any sense of humanity, you lose any sense of just the basic joys of being alive. And I think that's really quite counterproductive. That's why, I mean, you know, in Tolkien's work, that's why I love the figure of Tom Bombadil so much, because he really encapsulates that. And for Tolkien, it did really arise out of that Northern European kind of spirit that you find, especially in the Kalevala, but also to an extent in some of the Eddas and these other works from the far north, which were not unique in the world. They just held out a bit longer than the rest of Europe in the sense of holding on to animistic and pagan traditions before Christianization. But that is core to our being as humans, and you can find it everywhere. And I do think it's vitally important that we find those entryways and that we find ways to bring the lightness back into these kinds of areas of study and inquiry. Because as Joseph Campbell said, you know, it's like we're not what we are lusting after, what we're looking for is the rapture of being alive. That's the thing that we really fundamentally want. And it doesn't have to come from some institutional religion that tells us what to believe. I arguably that's the worst place to get it from. But there's many other sources of inspiration, enchantment, and joy and rapture that we can find and pull from. And I definitely think that, you know, works like this book, and I expect like other books that you've written as well, they really, I think, point us in that direction. They give us some guideposts and how to really be able to look at the world in a different way and live differently. So I really appreciate what you've done, and I wish you all the
Thank you.
success on the book. And yeah,
Well,
I
thank you.
really appreciate also you having this conversation with me today.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. And if people are curious, they can go to mikefiorito.com, and you have a list of the books. And if you have a question, but it's been such a pleasure talking to you, and you've gifted me with your take on the book was just absolute music to my ears, and it was the way I'd hoped people would receive it. So thank you so much.
A big thank you to Mike for joining us on today's episode. To find out more about his books and other work, please visit mikefiorito.com. That's MikeFiorito.com. And for more information about Unseen Beings, the book and the podcast, please visit unseen-beings.com. And for any of those that might be interested, I have finally started a Substack called The Spirited and Storied Earth. There you can find a selection of papers, blog posts, and articles on a wide range of topics, including unseen beings, Tibetan Buddhism, traditional medicine, and Tolkien studies. You can check this out at ericjampa.substack.com. Until next time, thanks for listening, and please take care.